Let's see. The editing room should be right. Ah, here it is. Hey, Mark.
Hey, John. Hey, here, just finishing up the fuss about the next episode.
I see that. What is all over the floor?
Oh, those are interview segments and the bits that we didn't have time to include in our last batch of episodes. You look through them if you want.
Well, yeah. Let's see. Oh, here's one from Bill Tannenbaum and another from Tom Redman. There's a whole bunch of really great stuff here. You know, I bet there's enough for a whole episode.
Yep, inspect there is. Let's do one. Sediment from rock bottom.
All the tidbits that slipped through the net the first time. Let's dive right in. This is John Ladley.
And Mark Cooper. Welcome to a special episode of the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Well, we made it.
Yep. Season one is in the can. And along the way, we learned about podcasts, production, and started to get the message out.
We're already thinking about next season, and with all modesty, I think it will be great.
As long as we find out what happened to Bob Twitt.
Absolutely. We'll be covering new topics and revisiting some old ones, like AI.
I'm looking forward to that one.
What was that?
Never mind. In the meantime, let's put something together to tide everyone over.
I think we can do that. When we do these guest segments, we often end up talking for a half hour or more.
And that's a little too much for the format of our show.
And the editorial decisions usually have more to do with the theme of the show than the quality of the conversation.
And that's why we thought it was important to bring you these deleted scenes and outtakes from season one of the Brock Bottom Data Feed. We'll start with Stacey Clark, our first guest on our first episode, The Fuss About Data, being reminded that not every project goes according to plan.
So along the way, there's been some tough stuff too. What could have gone better? You know, what are some, give me like three things that you're just like, wow, you guys, this was nuts. And, you know, and I know it can affect your career. You have been asked to go work somewhere else because of your data governance program. So.
Yeah, that's true, John. Thanks for bringing that up.
Hey, anytime, pal, I can bring up the bad stuff.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, you try to learn from those things, and then you find out that what you learn doesn't apply the next time around. So I always tell my team is that I'm always looking for Vuja Day. And that's the feeling that this has never happened before, because it's the only safe approach that I have now is I can't say, oh, yeah, I've seen it and here's how I'm going to respond. But what I can say is I need to know the political landscape. I need to know who's invested 40 years of their life doing this thing the wrong way before I start making announcements. The other thing is to get the coverage. You really need the air cover of an executive sponsor. And you and I experienced that at the company that you were talking about at the C-level. He didn't claim to understand everything there was to know about governance. In fact, he probably didn't want to know it, but he wanted to know how it would help him achieve certain goals. Mm-hmm. If I could describe to him how that could happen, he was on my side. And you really need that air cover, because they can give you insights. They can tell you about the minefields and the personalities that you may impact. And the other thing is do not do a data governance centric approach. The things that have changed over time, John, is that people think they know data governance, and they think that know that it must have something to do with data, and it probably has something to do with electricity. And so that means it's an IT thing. And so it really isn't. And so that's what happens. We've got a lot of charlatans with data governance in their backgrounds and on their resumes that don't know it.
That's good stuff. That is good stuff. Wendy Lawhead had a lot to say about data science and AI in The Fuss About AI. Here, she talks more about the challenges of AI governance.
I'm here with Wendy Lawhead, director and team lead for Pfizer's commercial analytics engineering team. Now, Wendy, you've worked in the data science and AI areas for several different companies over the past two decades, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts about how companies can ensure that their AI-driven analytics are ethical and unbiased.
Sure. This is a huge topic that everybody's speaking about. It doesn't matter what industry you're in or what organization you're involved in. Everybody's trying to figure out the best ways to implement you know, AI and machine learning tools in a way that's going to impact, you know, their customers and the public in a way that's positive and not negative. And it's a challenge because there's a lot of unknowns. You know, a lot of our leaderships and organizations don't really understand all the things that are involved in building these models. And it's an unknown, and having, you know, something that's unknown that's driving business value in your organization, and you have to make sure that you're monitoring and governing it, is kind of a challenge. So what I've seen across the enterprises right now that I've been involved in, you're usually seeing leadership putting together monitoring and boards that are, you know, looking at their models to seeing what types of things are resulting in that. So continuous monitoring for bias, making sure obviously that the data that they're using in their models are representative of, you know, the community. You know, diverse training sets are important because you don't want anything to, you know, bias your models in a way that's going to impact people negatively. And transparency, you know, we were speaking about explainable AI again. It's like having some sort of framework in place so that when a model is deployed, you're able to actually speak to what it is that went into that model, what kind of logic or whatever kind of data, you know, drove the type of results that, you know, resulted. And so being able to explain that is really important. And, you know, organizations are doing this in all different types of ways. Google's got an AI ethics board. Microsoft's put together like an AI principles that emphasizes fairness and transparency and all of that. But IBM's got one too. They developed an open source tool called AI Fairness 360, which is interesting. And I thought that was interesting because it helps organizations detect and mitigate bias in their AI models. So now you've got vendors that are actually pushing out tools that'll help organizations, you know, ensure the ethics and fairness in their models too, which is helpful. So there's a whole marketplace right now. And then, you know, we have data governance, you know, organizations and you know, enterprises, but now we're going to have AI and ethics as part of that as well. And so it's just, you know, it's just monitoring.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
Saving 2% as a result of data governance is a big deal. So too is the fact that only 3% of corporate data was found to meet quality standards. Tom Redman talked about both in The Fuss About Data Quality.
That 2%'s there, isn't it? I mean, that's really what we've talked about a lot.
You mentioned the 2%, John, and I'm really proud of that number that we came up with, right? With respect to data, look, there's a lot of sort of statistics running around the data quality space. And IBM put out a figure a long time ago, and so maybe 10 years ago, that, you know, bad data cost the U.S. $3.1 trillion. I said that. Trillion. And, you know, and then what we began, you know, I did some work with some guys in Ireland, and we assembled an actual database of actual quality measures that we could make public. And it was really interesting because, you know, only 3% met basic quality standards.
Yeah.
Say to somebody, well, how good your data need to be? And say, well, 100%. So, okay, well, you're at 62. You know,
exactly.
Kind of thing. And then the most recent thing, compelling argument, came from some work at McKinsey, and they estimate across a company, 30% of people's time is non-value-added work associated.
Oh.
Right? So.
Oh, yeah. I just have to work in any organization. And well, that's why I'm self-unemployed, because that just made me bats. anyway, thanks. Randy Bean publishes the results of an annual survey examining data-driven, discussed in the aptly named episode, The Fuss About Data-Driven. We're looking forward to this year's results. In the meantime, in this clip, Randy talks more about societal and cultural changes driven by AI and goes into more detail about survey respondents' interpretation of the term data-driven. Yeah. Okay, so a little slight gear shift here then. With all this data, with the potential of AI, what we've already seen from big data and analytics. And we see everyday people now talking about this. We see commercials during football games advertising AI capabilities. Everything is AI driven now. My product is AI driven. And you get that during intermission in the movie theater when they put an ad up or something like that. that to me tells me that this data, it's trickling into society. And some of the changes we're talking about aren't just at the organization, like a corporation or a government or an NGO, but it's also weaving into society. What are some of the thoughts you have on what I call, and that's what when I'm a book I'm writing right now, is on the anthropological aspect of our super data. We've always had a data-driven world when the Industrial Revolution started, but it is so saturated now with data that there's some sort of anthropology here. Do you see that there are societal and not organization culture, but external cultural things going on that a CEO has to deal with around data?
Yeah, I think this is most analogous to the introduction of the internet and the digital experience 25 or so years ago. Last year at this time, next month, I'll be doing the same thing this month. I went to the Wall Street Journal Tech Live event, which is a small group event held in Laguna Beach each year, about 200 folks. So you get to interact with the other participants. And last year, the key participant and speaker was Sam Altman from OpenAI. And what they were asking him about was not generative AI and those type of things, but they said, you know, let's talk about what lies ahead. So can you talk about artificial general intelligence? And he said, sure. And they said, what is that? And he said, that's the stage where a machine, a computer, can do any cognitive task equal to or better than a human being. And the moderator said, so when will this become available? When we start to see it in business and in society? And he said, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would have said within the next decade. If you asked me a year ago, I would have said within the next 5 years. If you'd asked me 6 months ago, I'd say within the next 2 to 3 years. If you're asking me tonight, I have to go back in the lab and check.
Yeah.
So, you know, this stuff is coming along so rapidly, and it really exceeds the pace of companies, individuals to fully take advantage and leverage the technology. But the capabilities are emerging as we speak all around us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of a CEO's job description is you know, run the company, corporate governance, and then this thing like reputation, ethics, make sure you fit into the marketplace and society, because, you know, a big Fortune 500 company makes a heck of a footprint in a region, in a town, in people's lives. And I think this, maybe another way to express what you just said is, yes, I'm sitting here as a CEO and I need to think about not only the cool things I'm going to do with my products and AI and stuff, but what are we going to do for my region and my neighborhood, and how is this going to impact my employees? And this is serious, heady stuff to sit and noodle on. It's not a project anymore. We say data governance isn't a project, data management, that's ho-hum. This stuff has nothing to do with what we've done before. There are days when I feel like we're stepping across a glacier that no human being has ever trod upon. There's no footprints on it sometimes with this stuff.
Well, you know, you can have a conversation with anyone. For example, a few months ago, I was having lunch with a Boston hotelier. So he runs a series of hotels and restaurants in Boston. And he was saying, because he thinks I know a lot about AI, he said, hey, you know, I want to let you know I'm experimenting with generative AI, and it's able to do a series of back office functions. And maybe within a year or two, I'll have many of those back office functions performed by AI. And I said, you know, that's very possible. And he said, but we'll still need the wait staff. And I said, no, you won't. And he said, what do you mean? I said, robots. And, you know, I've told that story a couple of times, and I've had people say, yes, we were in Tokyo and we went to a restaurant. We were served by these little R2-D2 things that had our food. So
these
things may seem far-fetched, but they're there in many instances.
The Jetsons are coming. I'm going to put my application into Cogswell Cogs here. Okay. Could there be some interpretation here when I read that? And if I have a question, you know, have we created a data-driven organization? And often in organizations, I'll run into two contexts there. One is our enterprise is data driven, or I have created a data driven organization, which in the case of a few clients I've worked with has been a top secret lab funded off in a corner somewhere. And that scientists are producing cool stuff, but I wouldn't call that integrated into normal everyday business behavior, right? It's a shining point of light, but I wouldn't call that you'd made the cultural change to be full data-driven data supply chain or anything. Is there a possibility there's interpretations there, or do you guys squeeze that out of the survey somehow?
I'd say two things. First of all, 97% of the respondents are C-suite executives, so good. It's the highest level people that are responding. But the other thing is I learned early on in conducting the survey, and this was the 12th year that conducted it, is I asked very simple yes or no questions. So yeah. The interpretation is in the eyes of the responder.
Okay.
Because otherwise it becomes too nuanced to be meaningful. So it's like, John, are you data-driven or not? And it's kind of like, give your first best answer. So, you know, there can be a whole underlying level of complexity and nuance underneath that, but it's a yes or no question.
But well, and there's value to that too. There is a lot of value to that. I mean, I'll do a lot of surveys with Likert scales on them. And you have to just say the first impression, your gut, don't think about it. Don't think about it. Just answer it. Because as soon as you start to think about it, we're off into the ditch, you know.
Well, if with every question I had, instead of yes or no, if I had yes, no, or maybe, it would probably be 90% of maybe for every question.
Which I put in the negative bucket. I equal that to a no. Anyway, if you're going to be wishy-washy and you're getting paid the big bucks, that's a no.
In our final first season outtake from our final episode, The Fuss About Data and the Law, Bill Tannenbaum provides some insights into data licensing and the data supply chain. But before we get to Bill, a quick shout out to our sponsor, Hubris Data Pros. Call on Hubris to make the leftovers delicious.
Yeah, no risk there. Hey, and to make sure my data quality is right, are you referred to as William or Bill? Because you mentioned that you're referred to as both. So here at the pod, we want to be hip and with it for the AI folks. So do I say thank you, William, or do I say thank you, Bill?
Yes.
So you have a surrogate key, as we say in the data, world. All right. Hey, go ahead.
I want to mention something before we go.
Oh, absolutely.
So a lot of the problem with licensing data is that the generic way to do this, which comes from tech agreements, is to use a field of use. A, a field of use is too broad. B, most companies you're dealing with are in the same field of use that you're doing. And C, when you try and divide it up, from a lawyer's point of view, it's just a landmine waiting to go off. Because that's not a usable division. Yeah. So I mentioned, I think this is important, that decision rights, which is the model I've used, is one that defines the scope of use in terms of the scope of decisions that you can make using the data. Quick example, if you're a company that's doing medicine for children, what do you want? You want leading indicators of whatever illness you're trying to fix. So you will license the data from a hospital that has a huge pediatric practice. The hospital wants to be able to license that data to pharma companies for clinical studies, et cetera, et cetera. So if you license the data that says you can take this data, but the decision rights are you can only use the data that's relevant to your medicine. So that is a way of kind of accommodating everybody's interest without getting in the soup of other kinds of scope of use. So I found that very useful. The second thing is data is not a unitary asset in a corporate transaction. So what I do in agreements is I divide up the data into different categories in order to allocate rights and responsibilities to particular categories. I just did an agreement with 8 different types of data, and it actually worked very well. And it made the negotiations a lot easier because people didn't have a fear that they were giving up or not getting enough. So this is a way to introduce precision, which helps the business strategy.
Excellent.
Can I make one more point?
In AI, data is really your supply chain. The same way in manufacturing, your raw materials, the components, everything that goes into a machine is a supply chain.
Yep.
The components breaking, you're going to manufacture a machine that breaks. Mm-hmm. If the data is not reliable, you're going to get weirdo AI results. So to answer your question, you know, the combination of all the different people is to make sure that the data at all the different steps is, you know, legally compliant and from a data professional's point of view, reliable.
That there's a lot of work going on right now in that. We're going to be talking next season with someone who's running their entire corporate data assets on a data supply chain metaphor like that, and applying all the rule of total quality and business reengineering and kind of demingizing how they treat their data. And I use that metaphor a lot, but I think it's curious on your thoughts on this. I think it's more than a metaphor. I think a CEO needs to have, at least in their head, and maybe even on some sort of poster in their office behind their door, of some representation of that data supply chain. Where's it coming? Where's it going? Maybe some bright pink dots where there's data agreements, maybe some bright blue dots where there are decision rights documented or something like that, that they need to know it. Because it's no different than, is it, if I'm a CEO and I'm in a business making cars and I have 20 car plants. As a CEO, I certainly know I have 20 car plants, don't I? I certainly know who my big suppliers are. And I certainly know some level of things about those car plants and what they're up against and dealing with in environmental concerns and legal concerns and society concerns, all that. I mean, this doesn't seem to be a stretch. I think CEOs should be aware of their data supply chain. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, because I think it's both a framework that helps you decide how to do things from a business and legal point. And also, it just makes sense because, you know, you want to turn your data into information, you want to turn your information into insights, and you want to turn your insights into an actual business plan.
Absolutely.
All that depends on, if you're running digital twins, it would be nice to do a twin of something that you trust. You may, I don't know who's on the audience, and this may be the wrong thing, but there's probably an argument that, you know, some of the Boeing problems were not just manufacturing problems, but there wasn't enough data supervision to catch these problems earlier.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Especially if you're using data to model something.
Yep. Yep. We, part of our podcast is to call, babies that are ugly, ugly. So we kind of think the industry, the data industry, has been sugarcoating things for a while. So we're part of our mission is to kind of step away from that. At any way, the data supply chain is powerful. It's more than a metaphor. It is something that needs to be built into strategy and managed. It's a relevant artifact in the organization.
Yeah. So to your metaphor, you don't want to have a huge recall of your cars. That's
right.
Just not good.
And so, you can't recall data. You spill your data, you can't get it back. It's, you know, it's worse than oil. All right. You know, it's out there. It is. Once it's in the ether, it is you can never get it all back in and hide it again. It's gone. It's it. It's gone. We're having so much fun with this. It's just, if you do get a chance, Rock Bottom Data Feed is on Apple. It's on Spotify. You'll find that our production values are extremely high. We're going to be at DGIQ. I guess you're going to be at DGIQ, correct? For a day?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm not actually sure. I might have a schedule problem.
If you are, stop by. We're going to have a table and some microphones set up, and we're going to be doing a special episode of just capturing impressions on the show. And hey, your decision rights things, it sounds a lot like Gwen Thomas's stuff too. You guys chat very much? She's big into the decision rights things too. I think it's brilliant, by the way. I think you are onto something that helps us codify, and this was off topic, so I didn't talk about it, but codify and categorize and help people think better through this stuff than just going, oh, you should do this. I mean, you're giving people a tool, and I think that's wonderful. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, you have to operationalize this stuff, and you need a way to do it.
Yes. Yeah, perfect. I mean, and that's absolutely perfect.
Recently, we brought the Rock Bottom Data Feed crew,
which is just us,
to DGIQ in Washington, D.C., where we spoke with several of the attendees.
You'll hear more from them in upcoming episodes.
In the meantime, a few played our famous game show. First up is Nicole Bills.
We should challenge her with the ultimate challenge.
I think we should challenge her with the ultimate challenge.
Gosh, it's time for the dun, dun, dun.
Famous game show, the okay. Audio Data Rorschach Test.
Okay.
Well, the way this works is that we will play you a snippet of public domain royalty-free music.
Okay.
Because we have such a large budget.
We can't play anything that was recorded for sale because we have to pay a royalty.
Okay, cool.
And we have no money.
Got it.
Okay,
yep.
So.
Yep, despite the opulence of our surroundings.
Very.
And what we need from you is the first thing that pops into your head.
Okay.
Related to data.
Okay.
Related to data.
Okay.
We appreciate, you know, your graduation. We appreciate, the trip to Aruba.
Yeah.
We appreciate, you know.
But we don't care.
No.
No, we don't care.
No. Yeah.
But if it's about data, yeah.
Data, definitely.
Because we don't have lives.
No.
But it's about data. We think it's cool.
We live vicariously through our guests.
So I will play the song, shall we?
Shall we?
All right. And we play off my laptop speaker because, again, we don't know what we're doing. Okay, here we go. Okay.
Wow. What? That was so nice.
Yes, it was.
That was so sweet.
Okay, so what does it trigger? What does it evoke in terms of your profession?
Yeah, it sounded like some kind of. I was definitely thinking like data visualizations of this kind of snippet of music. It was very friendly, like a scatter plot is very approachable.
A friendly scatter plot.
Yeah.
That's the name of an episode.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should give her every prize we have.
Every prize. You win them all.
We don't have any.
That's
okay.
Perfect. That's, my luggage is full.
There you go.
All right. Well, Nicole, thank you very much
Thanks,
for
Nicole.
Joining us.
Fun. Thanks for
you.
Being a good sport. Appreciate
yeah.
it. Next in the hot seat is Anne Marie Smith.
What we're going to do is play a snippet of public domain music, and we want to hear your first thing that pops into your head related to data.
Okay.
So, in order to maintain the illusion of randomness, pick a number between 1 and 4.
3.
Okay, 3.
All right. What do you get?
My first thought, data war.
Yeah.
Data war.
Yes.
All right. War. Who's on which side? Yeah. Who's on the other?
Technology on one side, business units on the other.
Ooh.
Oh, the old user versus business versus tech war.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's serious. That's like spy movie, helicopters. So I've been to a few meetings like that.
Yeah. When I think of data, that's what I think of. Like a scene out of the beginning of The Terminator. Our third and final contestant is Trisha Prosser.
So I might listen to a podcast for the first time.
So the way this works is that we play a snippet of public domain music, and whatever pops into your head related to data is
this
whatever.
Could be quite dangerous.
Whatever.
So
we hope so.
Let me turn the speaker up here.
This is reminding me of marketing data, where you need hits on websites from everywhere in the world, and no amount is enough.
There you go.
No amount is fast enough. We are headed for doom.
Nothing evokes emotions like a 1950s movie stinger, right?
That's what
that's what that is. This broadcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Counterthreaded is not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that might arise from the use of this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast may not be those of the host or the management. This podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice.
We hope that you've enjoyed this cleaning out of the pantry, so to speak. Perhaps hearing some of our past guests again has inspired you to go back and listen to their full episodes. The new season of the Rock Bottom Data Feed is coming soon, and we would love to hear from you. Write us with your thoughts, ideas, and feedback at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the show.
Until next time, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening. And remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom.
You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, the fuss about the constraints of time, and about all of our season one episodes at our website, counterthreadedproductions.com.
The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a Counter Threaded production, copyright 2025, all rights reserved.